Coffee House Shots is sponsored by EDF, Britain's biggest generator of zero carbon electricity. Find out how we are busy helping Britain achieve net zero at www.edfenergy.com.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots. I'm James Forsyth and I'm joined by Katie Balls on a day of drama here in Westminster. We have had a cabinet reshuffle today and it has been more extensive than many had expected. It's had its moments of dramas and its spills. Katie, do you think this reshuffle counts as a success for the Prime Minister?
I think it's too early to tell. I think that we can see it as a statement of intent from the Prime Minister. I think it's a show of his authority that he has embarked on this reshuffle, and it's not a particularly timid reshuffle. It's fairly sizable. If you look at some of the ministers who have just been cast out completely, so Gavin Williamson has lost his job, Robert Jenrick has lost his job, Robert Buckland, Amanda Milling. And I think that each one of those tells us something, in the sense that there was lots of speculation and governments would not keep it on his role in education, but that he could move to something else, perhaps leader of the House, because they were ultimately worried about having someone who was an organiser on the backbenches. I think the fact that Boris Johnson has decided that he is not sufficiently worried about that tells you about something where he is mentally at the moment in terms of the unruly party. And I think that he is in quite a punchy mood. Someone described it to me as he's in world king mode, feeling all powerful at the moment. And then I think you can see with Robert Jenrick. Now, both Williamson and Robert Jenrick were ministers we knew had a difficult time with their brief, who fell lower in those Conservative home rankings. But Robert Jenrick is also someone who was in that trio, Rishi Sunak, Oliver Dowden and Robert Jenrick, who backed Boris Johnson early on in leadership. And it's seen by many on the campaign as that pivotal point when things turned in Boris Johnson's favour and lots more MPs started coming on board. So I think at one point, Jenrick was seen as a rising star. So the fact that you act someone who's fairly young in terms of their career is interesting. And then on Robert Buckland, I think what's interesting there is, in a way, no one saw that one coming. But ultimately, the Prime Minister needs to make space for other people he wants to promote. So I think it feels as though the Prime Minister feels rather assured in how he's carried this out so far.
Yeah, and one thing that could have derailed this reshuffle would have been if Dominic Raab, who was the Foreign Secretary this morning, had refused to leave his job. Now, it seems that after some tense negotiations, he's agreed to become Justice Secretary with a kind of consolation title of Deputy Prime Minister. How real do you think that title is, Katie? I mean, Fraser's written an interesting thing saying, you know, that sometimes this title means nothing, other times it means something. What's your instinct on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, not to be incredibly boring, but time will tell. I think the fact that it's come up in the way it has.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the key, isn't it? It appears to only have been offered to kind of grease the wheels, if you see what I mean. It's hard to imagine that there's a huge role envisaged.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way it's come up in a bad-tempered negotiation by all accounts of someone who didn't want to be demoted and don't think it took it very well, it does suggest it's more there just to ease things and to get Dominic Raab into position when he would actually take another job. But obviously it's there to be what Raab makes of it. And it'd be interesting if he can take what is ultimately a dent to his authority, in the sense this is a demotion, and turn it into something else. I think the tricky thing for Dominic Raab is it just widely looks as though he's had a very difficult time on Afghanistan. His reputation has been tarnished as a result of it. And now he's been demoted from the Foreign Office. I do think it's worth remembering, though, that Boris Johnson and Dominic Raab do have that relationship dating back to when he stood in for him and Boris Johnson in intensive care. So you can see how Deputy Prime Minister works, but then you go back to the point, which is he was effectively the de facto Deputy Prime Minister anyway. So it's just a slightly more formalised title to soften the blow. What do you think, James?
I mean, look, the British Constitution's title for Deputy Prime Minister is First Secretary of State. You know, there is, in the order of precedence, all of these things, continuity of government. There is no role for Deputy Prime Minister. There is a role for a First Secretary of State. So I think giving him this title means nothing. I think you're right. I mean, if it hadn't been for what happened in Afghanistan over the summer, the whole row over Dominic Raab's holiday and the like, you could have imagined someone with a straight face saying, look, you know, justice is a big job. You know, there's not only the court's backlog, but there's the whole issue of judicial review and a British Bill of Rights, which Dominic Raab had worked on back when David Cameron was Prime Minister and Michael Gove was Justice Secretary. He's First Secretary of State. We're bringing him into this big domestic briefing. I think it's very hard to say that after everything that's happened with Afghanistan over the summer. I also think it is made harder by his replacement as Foreign Secretary in Liz Truss. You know, Liz Truss has, you know, she is very popular with the Tory grassroots, regularly tops that Conholme satisfaction table. And, you know, she represents a kind of, I think, a different approach to being Foreign Secretary to Dominic Raab. You know, you've written extensively about the Truss trade agenda, but she has been a very upbeat presence for Britain on the world stage. She's not perceived as taking the kind of Dominic Raab very micromanaging approach. She's much more big picture, optimistic about Britain and the future, and
more Instagram.
Yeah, it is obviously a big promotion for her, and you know, there is also, I think, one of the problems that Dominic Raab runs into, which all foreign secretaries run into, is the Foreign Office doesn't have, I mean, and one of the reasons that DFID was put into the Foreign Office is the Foreign Office doesn't have the power it once used to have. A lot of international diplomacy is done directly by number 10 on a prime minister to other head of government level. You know, and also remember, Europe policy sits effectively under David Frost in the Cabinet Office. So the Foreign Office is not the department it once was. But DFID going into it certainly gives the Foreign Office a much bigger budget and the potential to play, to have more influence than it had before. I also think it's interesting on a machinery of government point that the UK is not going down the Japanese road of rolling together the Foreign Affairs Ministry and the Department of Trade, many people in Whitehall see this as quite a logical move that the UK should do. And Truss's appointment would have been an obvious moment to do it. But I think having already put one department into the Foreign Office, I think it would have been probably considered too much moving of the Whitehall deck chairs to have had it absorb another.
Now, James, we're speaking and the reshuffle is not over. We're still looking at the cabinet appointments, but we then expect junior ministerial appointments to continue through to tomorrow. But looking at the appointments we currently have, one of the most striking relates to Michael Gove. He has moved from his role in the Cabinet Office to the Housing Secretary role. What's behind this? And can you talk us through the several parts of his brief?
So I think the Michael Gove appointment is fascinating. Michael Gove has essentially been sent to his department, it looks like, to solve three problems. First of all, the government has a planning bill, but at the moment, we haven't seen the bill. The bill hasn't been published yet. But all the signs are it will not get through the House of Commons in its intended form, because there is a large amount of Tory backbench opposition to it. You know, it's something that's been exacerbated by the Tory party's shock loss in the Chesham and Amersham by-election. Michael Gove, who did the housing brief for the Tories in opposition back in 2006 or so, has been sent there. He's also a Surrey MP to try and kind of work out some, you know, what reforms will actually make a difference and can get through the Commons. And I think that's one of the reasons Robert Jenrick has gone, is an attempt to kind of reset relations with backbenchers on this topic. So that's the kind of first problem he's got to solve. The second thing is he's been put in charge of a cross-government effort on levelling up. Now, this is interesting because, you know, this government is looking for a new mission. You know, Brexit is, in inverted commas, done. Obviously, there are still huge numbers of things that are not yet resolved. But, you know, but it is not the political issue it once was. The COVID crisis appears to be receding. If you look at the government's plan A and plan B for the winter, they are, I think, what we would all have considered a few months back, a relatively mild series of measures. And levelling up is the obvious contender to be the new purpose of a government. But at the moment, it's so broad a concept, as at times it feels almost meaningless because there are so many parts to it. So I think it's his job to give levelling up some intellectual definition. And he is also taking the kind of government effort on the union with him to the department, which is interesting because that creates not only a link between levelling up and the union, but it also means that English local government and all the mayors in England and all those devolution deals in England sit within the same department now as relations with the devolved administrations in Scotland and Wales. I think that is interesting when you consider how many people think that one way to kind of to deal with the union question is to kind of rebalance the constitution with a broader devolving of powers away from Whitehall. So, you know, you end up with more powerful mayors in Manchester, the West Midlands, Liverpool, maybe even kind of county mayors in England as well, and that you get to a more generally devolved system of government in the UK away from the all-powerful Westminster model, which is called, you know, and that is seen as a way of rebalancing the constitution so you have less conflict between the DAs and Westminster.
James, I think on paper, many people who have seen Gove's move from his previous role to community secretary as a downgrade, but actually, is the fact that it's attached to levelling up the union, and also the fact that planning reform is so important to Boris Johnson's agenda, I mean, that it's not, I suppose, how conventionally would have been otherwise?
I think Michael Gove's kind of lot in life is to be sent to solve problems, but because of all those various lingering trust issues, which I think are less of an issue than they were, but are still there.
The Prime Minister.
I think that he's never going to kind of get one of these great offices of state. And then I think also the other problem with these great offices of state are, you know, previously expressed views. You know, Michael Gove has very well-known views on foreign affairs. The Home Secretary job is obviously difficult given the stuff that came out in the Tory leadership contest about him having taken drugs in the beginning of his professional life. So I think this job is intellectually substantive, even if its position in the kind of traditional cabinet pecking order is not that high.
Now, looking at the other appointments we have so far, we know that Amanda Milling has left the role of Tory party chairman. James, that's for the one sacking we hadn't mentioned. Ultimately, she is an old retainer, a long-time supporter of Boris Johnson. Do you think in that Boris Johnson ultimately doesn't think that person's going to cause so much of a problem on the backbench?
Yeah, I also think that one of the things that made her position very difficult was a lot of Tory grumbling about the operations in both Chesham and Amersham and the Batley and Spen by-elections. I mean, the Batley and Spen by-election was close enough that the kind of flaws in the campaign, you know, lots of Tory MPs went up to campaign there and claimed that the kind of the party's canvassing software sent it to the wrong places. In Chesham and Amersham, the Tories adopted this kind of targeted voter strategy, and the argument is because they weren't knocking up their traditional supporters, they didn't see this kind of Lib Dem wave coming. So I think Amanda Milling was in on a sticky wicket on that front, and also in brutal terms, she does not have a huge following in the parliamentary party.
And looking at the other appointments, Priti Patel is staying put as Home Secretary despite speculation that she could be moved. And Rishi Sunak is also staying put in Number 11. So talk of a rift between Number 10 and Number 11 is not yet at a catastrophic levels when it comes to their relationship. But one of the quite interesting appointments, if you have Nadine Dorries promoted to Culture Secretary, what's her relationship to Boris Johnson?
She is very close to Boris Johnson, you know, in what one might term as kind of wilderness months after he resigned as Foreign Secretary over Chequers and before he became Prime Minister. She was one of his closest allies. And if you look at the video of his resignation statement, you'll see her sitting near him. She's long-time been an enthusiastic backer of him. I think her appointment to the Culture Secretary job is interesting. She is obviously herself a best-selling author, but she's also had some fairly robust views on the BBC. And so I think that will be an interesting tension there about, you know, ahead of a licence fee negotiation. I think the kind of, you can't imagine her favouring a hugely generous settlement towards the BBC, and you can imagine her wanting to know what the BBC was doing for its money and how it was addressing impartiality. And I think that does reflect a certain desire on the behalf of Number 10 to send a message on this front. You know, but they have not sent a natural conciliator into that job.
Now, we're still waiting for more appointments such as Education Secretary, and this podcast will bring you all the updates in our next recording. Potentially, it's a twice-a-day podcast day, or it could be early morning. But James, just to end the podcast, what do you think the current message of this reshuffle is? Because we know what Number 10 want it to be. They briefed out in advance when they finally confirmed these reshuffle rumours that it's a build back better reshuffle to get a united government ahead of the levelling up agenda. So quite a few of their classic phrases chucked in. What is reaching out to you?
I think this is a reshuffle about giving the government a purpose again after this. I mean, obviously, we wait to see who the new Education Secretary is, and I think that's a very important appointment. But I think what you see is, you know, Dominic Raab, yes, he's been demoted, but he's been sent to Justice where we know he has views. You know, he worked on this British Bill of Rights. He has views on judicial review from that time previously. Michael Gove, known views on housing, levelling up in the union, been sent there. Liz Truss, who is very in favour of the of what's called in government the kind of Indo-Pacific tilt, e.g. the idea that the UK should be investing more of its time and its resources on building diplomatic and international connections in that part of the world, the fastest growing bit economically, which is becoming increasingly important strategically with the rise of China. You know, she is going there, you know, and that there is obviously meant to be a fit there. I think it's interesting that her appointment comes on a day when we're expecting an announcement of a joint US-UK-Australia, you know, military technology pact. You know, again, all of it, I think this is the government which, at the beginning of this government, the aim was to drive every single thing from the centre. The number 10 joint treasury unit was all meant to be about, you know, an all-powerful centre kind of yoking together the cabinet office, number 10 and the treasury to drive everything through. I think what this reshuffle is a recognition of is that actually some of the ideas need to come out of some departments, and ministers need to kind of have, you know, not their own agendas in that number 10 doesn't know anything about them, but, you know, number 10 can't drive everything on its own. It needs departments with that are, and secretaries of state that are, have things that they want to get done.
Thank you, James, and thank you for listening.